to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Well, with Scott and Brian. I'm Scott, and joining me once again for this latest episode of Perry Mason, well, like I said, it's Brian. How you doing tonight, Brian?
Hey, Scott. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I apologize for my kind of fumfering with the opening there. As you know, just seconds ago, I tried to start recording, and the cat let out a huge caterwauling meow literally at the moment I hit record. And I'm like, really? Is that the way it's going to be tonight?
you sort of mimicked Perry, you know, up in front of the jury. You know?
Oh yeah, exactly. I just needed to have a coughing fit, and apparently not have my own pitcher of water fill.
Exactly.
Which is funny. I keep thinking of how many times I've seen that, both in, you know, TV dramas and even a couple real courtroom things where there's always, like, you know, the pitcher of water and someone pouring it, whatever. And I'm realizing, oh, they didn't do that. Did he forget? Did they just drink it all before he got a chance to talk? And that might have happened because they established that Barnes had been speaking for over 2 hours. So that must have been quite the opening statement he gave.
Oh, yeah.
So, in case you couldn't have figured out from that last minute or so, yes, we are here tonight to once again talk about Perry Mason. We are up to Chapter 6 of this 8-part series. Got a couple little bits of housekeeping and important news to kick off the podcast with. It seems like every week, either the show resolves a major question for us, on the Sunday episode, or in this case, we actually got news during the week, which actually resolved our biggest question for the last several weeks. Will there be a season 2 of Perry Mason? The answer is yes.
Yes, the answer is yes.
I am so excited for that news. It, you know what? It's been a year where there hasn't been a lot of good news. Let's be honest. And I know this is minor. It's a TV show, you know. But I'm so excited because, as we've been talking for the last several weeks, I mean, we both like the show from the get-go, of course, but I'm really enjoying where it's heading. And the fact that we can have a show that can build upon this season for a second season, if you can come up with a show that takes place in the 1930s, that is... takes the best aspects of being both a film noir homage as well as a courtroom drama, which, oh, by the way, at least when it comes to films, also one of my favorite genres when it's done right. Oh, that is so money for me. I will be there with bells on, you know, hey, if you can make, even though maybe he'll get written out by the end of the season or something, if he turned out to be way too corrupt, but if Stephen Root can come back next season as well, I was very excited to hear that. I couldn't wait to share it on the Facebook page.
Yeah, I was thrilled that we had mused about that at some length about what that meant, and you know, maybe we'll get to see Hamilton Berger next season. That's pretty exciting.
Oh, absolutely! I am excited. I mean, of course, with the way things are in the world, in the country, etc. It may be a little while before they can actually film that season, but at least we know it will eventually happen. That's the way I feel about all upcoming projects. We know that they're eventually going to happen. Whether it be, you know, when are they going to finish filming that latest season of Fargo? Or when are they going to get back to the Batman movie? Or whatever the heck it might be. We all have our own personal, you know, phase that we're looking forward to. But, yeah, very excited to hear that. I think it would be actually just be super geeky. I'm going to make a crazy ass prediction for season 2, which has no basis in reality other than Matthew Reeves is a producer on this show. And I just can see it happening. Someone else from the Americans is going to show up on the show in season 2.
Awesome.
I just feel that's going to happen. And I'm figuring if Maddie Boy has anything to say about it, someone's wife might show up in one episode. Come on, we want to see Kerry Russell in a 30s style outfit. That'd be great. I just want to see those two together because, you know, they're together. Anyway, that's when the sweat began. Huh? One of these days, I'm going to figure out how I can have the AC on in this room and this microphone not pick it up. So, yeah. Back to Perry Mason, Chapter 6. That is what we're here for. And one of the things that we were looking forward to with this episode was, okay, we're going to get to trial stuff now. The thing that intrigues me about that, it's not just in terms of the story and the character and seeing, okay, this is Perry Mason starting out. You know, he's clearly going to be rough around the edges. You know, he hasn't had the training. He knows something about the profession, as we saw earlier in the season. He certainly has sat in court or been on the witness stand a number of times, but he's never actually practiced law. So it's a little different. It's kind of like being an expert on watching a game show. And it's like, you know, you can nail every question when you want. It's the difference between that and actually being on the game show, where you start realizing, oh, now I understand why people panic and suddenly can't answer an obvious question. So I kept thinking that was kind of what was happening with Perry in this episode. You know, he can give an amazing dissertation in a kitchen in front of Della Street, you know, one night. But when it comes time to kind of pulling that off in a courtroom, and also not playing by the quote-unquote rules, it's a little different. So we are blessed, of course, to have someone who is an actual lawyer on this podcast. So you know I'm going to be asking you how you what you thought about how certain things were handled here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, as anyone knows, with very, very, very few exceptions, when you're watching courtroom dramas play out on the screen, film or television, there almost always has to be some, cutting the corners kind of a thing. Just, you know, you're doing it less for realism, more for dramatic purposes and tension and whatnot. Because I think just anyone who's actually had jury duty or at least one, court is not always the most exciting thing. But you have to play right. The drama of it. You know, either it's an episode of The Good Wife, or it's The Few Good Men, or it's Perry Mason. And you know they were going to be going that way for this. You know, it's noir. It's 1930s. It's, you know, I'm expecting someone to faint in the crowd and give a, you know, gasp across the courtroom and shit like that. But what I was curious about when I just looking at the beginning of the episode, where you have the opening from Barnes. And then we switch over to Perry and what happens to him while he's trying to deliver his statement. And I'm not referring just simply to his coughing attack, but just how he's interrupted, you know, with procedural rules and whatnot by the judge and by Barnes. And so I was curious what your take on what was with that. And also, have you actually ever, you know, as long as it's not like a super long anecdote, have you ever seen, you know, relative novices in court go through anything similar to that before as well?
Oh yes, absolutely. On both of those questions, the first to respond to what happened, it's not unusual, particularly in a high profile case. Most business at a courthouse is pretty routine, but in a high profile case, and I've had a few in my career where the courtroom's filled up, the news media is there, and there are high stakes. It, you know, there is a case of nerves and anxiety, and it does sometimes tend to make you close up a little bit, not be able to talk, a little bit of anxiety. But usually after you've done it a while, you can get talking and fight your way through it. And as for the procedural rules, I mean, there are a couple of things I thought were very realistic. One is particularly prosecutors will like to shut down new lawyers quickly if they can, if they run even the slightest afoul of the rules to try to assert their dominance, which is what, you know, he was doing, which Barnes was doing. To let sort of Perry know that's his courtroom. And we see later in the episode, it clearly is his courtroom. But I thought it was done well. The things, I mean, if you're a lawyer and you watch a show like this, you can sit. I mean, having taught trial practice and tried a lot of cases, there's stuff I could nitpick with it. But, you know, that's not why I watch the show. But the starting point, I thought Perry had the nugget of an opening statement. The thing I like that he did, that I do, that other lawyers do, is, yeah, you can play by the rules, but when a prosecutor is being an ass, you can make some comments to the side. You know, like if a prosecutor objects a number of times when you're making a point, you know, you can be exasperated for a second and say, you know, okay, we get it. We get it. You don't want to talk about this, but I'm going to keep asking the questions. And the judge can tisk-tisk you, but there's a little bit of showmanship to it. Yeah.
My apologies. It's almost like a staple of any sort of courtroom drama that I've watched, where just to get a notion in a jury's mind, they will deliberately do things that they know very well they can't say, and that will be objected to. There will be those side comments, because that's kind of, it's still a way of planting the seeds of either doubt or a specific idea or theory or whatever, and I thought that's what he was doing. Whether he knew he was going to get objected to from the get-go, I kind of doubt, but I think he kind of saw where it was going and was able to roll with it. Gosh, sorry. My apologies. I'm just trying to get the... I cannot hear my own audio right now, so it's kind of freaking me out. So sorry, kids. Hopefully this will sound fine. I just can't hear myself like I have for the last few weeks. So, well, do we want to... Brian, which would you prefer to do? We can kind of just sift our way through the different things that happened in trial, or we can move more chronologically through the episode. Which would you prefer? So I can go either way on this.
Whatever makes more sense to you. I enjoyed the sort of back and forth on it.
Okay. That's the way my notes are composed, so it's always going to be easier for me to go chronologically speaking. But I think with certain episodes of television, sometimes you want to kind of like separate the two. It's kind of like if we were talking about Better Call Saul, sometimes we want to do, let's do all the Jimmy stuff now, then we'll do all the Mike stuff, and whatever. But this, especially since everything, or practically everything, was interconnected, so I think it's okay to do that. Especially when we hit certain points where it's going to be like, I actually did get confused after, once we get past the opening statements in trial, and then we see that all hands are on deck, even Della's girlfriend is helping out. I got confused. Was the first time when we see them all together, was that at the boarding house, and then later it's at Perry's house, or is it always at Perry's house?
I thought it was Perry's house, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, again, it doesn't matter. I know that it only because when I wrote my notes, I wrote the boarding house simply because I saw her there, and then later on we see them all. I don't know if we see her or not, but we see them there at Perry's house. I was like, oh, maybe it was Perry's house to begin with, and I was like, oh, did Della bring her over? Oh, interesting. Anyway, just curious. Putting aside, you know, the little details that, you know, you find in some of these moments, like the fact, I mean, I did love Perry kind of confiding into Pete about his nerves, and which kind of underscores what we were just saying about, you know, or what I was saying, I guess, about how you may think that you can, you know, deliver, but all of a sudden once you're up there, you know, your brain is doing one thing, but your body is doing another. I mean, it's the classic why people don't like public speaking. You know, it's kind of like going along those lines. I really like the little moment where Della kind of had to rein Perry in, because no, Pete's the investigator, now the investigator. You're the lawyer on the case. So Perry can't be doing his usual, well, investigative work the way he normally does. Which I thought was really interesting.
I like that a lot, and I like that. I really liked when they had the conversation on the stoop, where Pete says, "Well, you know, gosh, Pete, I'd do this." Where he plays both parts of the conversation to sort of tell Perry, "Here's what you need to do, and here's what I need from you," because you see, like Della and Pete both are pushing him to be the lawyer and let them do their job so that they can work effectively as a team. And I thought that was really great.
Oh, that's absolutely one of my favorite scenes in the entire episode. both sides of the conversation. Which is also a theme of this episode, I might add. But
we'll get to that a little later.
I just figured out, whenever I mute my microphone and I take it off mute, that's what all of a sudden I lose the audio. And maybe it'll come back and maybe it will. Now I know I'm having technical issues in my heart. If you guys don't hear anything different, then.
You sound a little softer to me.
Okay, I'm not sure if I can. Well, you know what? When I do the post production, I'll fix that. Let me go.
Okay.
Maybe I'll just talk closer to the microphone. I don't know. All right. So, see, I keep crowing about the improved audio for the last couple of weeks. Now this has to happen. Now the cat's going to start meowing anytime.
It all started with a cat. The countdown to the cat.
But you know what? I'm not going to regret it because I definitely did have to mute my microphone because I did a major sneeze. And I didn't want to think everyone would get infected with corona via their iPods and whatnot. So
there you go. There you go. Consideration for our vast listening public.
Yeah. I don't want to let down our dozen listeners.
Exactly.
So back to the show. By the way, Della, better than most sketch artists I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, incredible. I mean, there's not much Della can't do with a pen or a typewriter. She's pretty impressive.
I mean, she's borderline Mary Sue on this show. Is there anything Della can't do?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, brilliant. A brilliant researcher. And we see her... continue to bend the rules a couple of times to help Perry, which, you know, we sort of talked about last time. And everybody in this episode sort of bends the rules a little bit because I think you're starting to see in court they're not getting a fair shake. And and so, you know, everyone starts to sort of reflexively fight back at it. And I really liked the way that they played things. And I mean, Della, I don't know if her and Perry worked out the thing later where they're looking at the logbooks, but you know, they sort of did like a scam where he sets the hat down and mm-hmm. she puts it in the bag. Like, I don't know if they worked on that or if that's just Della was wise enough to do that, but you see, like, they're really becoming a team to do these things, and a lot of advancement on seeing them build their teamwork to defend Dotson. So Emily, so it's really impressive. In the, you know, the last person we see later, you know, we'll see that with Drake later come into the picture, but bending the rules, having one-sided conversations sort of was the through line of this episode.
Oh, absolutely. And it goes to what you were saying, especially when you're aware that what the other side is doing is 10 times worse. I mean, they are actually having people perjure themselves on the stand and concocting things and, you know, just out-and-out falsehoods, you know, as opposed to, you know, kind of playing fast and loose with, you know, the rules of evidence or whether this was actually given to them or not, or those kind of things. There's a big difference between, I mean, obviously they're all legal. They're all breaking the law to a certain extent, but there's breaking the law and there's breaking the law.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, if you believe the maxim that, you know, it's better for a guilty person to go free than, you know, an innocent person to go to jail. There's nothing more offensive to the justice system when an innocent person goes to prison, to me. And they all really believe in their client. And you see the cheating and all the dirty tricks. And I can say some of those dirty tricks are very real, and that, you know, they're sort of a cliche for a reason. The document dump of burying, you know, giving you so much discovery, you can't make sense of what matters and what doesn't. I've had that happen. We're sorry, we thought we gave this to you at trial. those things are very real and still occur in the 21st century. So, those things are real. They're unfair. And believe me, when you're in court and that happens, you do get upset. And that's when maybe you do some of the things Perry says. Now, I've never been in a judge's chambers and said, you know, that's fucking bullshit. but, you know, seeing him do it, I can't say that I disliked it. It made me want to do it.
Oh, man. I mean, scenes like that, although they probably certainly go back even further, but for someone who's as much of a film fan as I am and as old as I am, it takes me back to, like, you know, an iconic scene from The Verdict when Paul Newman's character, the lawyer, is basically ripping into the judge in the judge's own chambers and saying things which would definitely probably lead him to be disbarred and thrown the hell out of his office and out of the law completely. So whenever I see anything like that happen in a judge's chambers in any TV show or movie since that, I'm always like, oh, they're having a verdict moment. Got it. You know?
Yeah.
And that was written by some guy named Mamet. So, you know, it's not like he knows anything about writing scenes or anything.
exactly.
So back to the episode. So our first segment with Perry at the trial, not so great for Perry. But he certainly does better than in the second time we see him in the trial proceedings. And that's when they've got Matthew Dodson on the stand. And I kind of like the way Perry kind of really sunk his teeth into that and really kind of went after him. And I think what was fueling that, not just because he's trying to win for his client, I think Perry himself is also feeling a sense of betrayal because of, you know, of what's happened with this person who was originally his client. And this was, you know, a happy couple. And it's understandable for the man to be upset that he's been at the very least cuckolded, or if not, you know, just out and out cheated on, whatever. But to have gone 180 degrees to basically accusing his own wife of, you know, being a kidnapper, being a murderer, and finally that the kid might not even be his to begin with. But I don't think that necessarily hurt their case. I thought Perry did very well in that section. And by the way, just because I had to just figure it out, just because I was curious, when he's piecing together all the things about Dodson on the stand, that, you know, how he lied, how the sin of omission by never talking about Bagley was his father, and how he lied to the police about his whereabouts, and they was playing dice, and they mentioned a debt. He was in debt for, you know, like $3,000. Just so people know, $3,000 in the early 1930s, that would be roughly equal to someone being in debt roughly like $45,000 now. So when you see that, scene and you're thinking, oh, $3,000, how much was that? Was that really a lot of money? It's like, that would be like if you heard someone was like $45,000 in debt now, which, that's a lot of money.
So. Yeah.
Unless your dad's a millionaire, then it doesn't matter. See? But once again, I was like, thank you, Google.
So, right.
Let me go through. So then we did get that little bit with Pete going to the cleared out Gannon house, and that's where he finds that box of mail, which leads to that later scene that we already referred to about those checks he found, the uncashed checks that were made out. They were supposed to be sent to the Sunray Services Inc. or something, which had the same address as George Gannon. They had come from the church, that whole business. Okay, just because I don't want to spend that much time on it, because I feel like this is one of those things that people's eyes tend to glaze over with when it's, I'm just going to call it an unfortunate but consistent film noir trope. It's that additional hairy bit of plotting that it's not just plotting, it's sometimes a bit plotting, two D's, not two T's there. It's the kind of thing that if you try to explain it, it's almost like trying to explain some of the final episode of Lost or something, where you feel like you're going to spend 20 minutes to explain something and they'll just stare. It's like, does it really need to be that complicated? But they all have this. I mean,
right.
Some are a little bit simpler than others, but we always call it, it's the Chinatown thing. Because Chinatown, anyone who's listening, who's seen Chinatown, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you haven't seen Chinatown and you've got a reasonable amount of intelligence, your homework assignment is to go watch Chinatown, just so you know. But anyway, so I won't spoil it other than saying there's a little bit of plot. There's a big mess, not a bit of plotting in Chinatown, which is like that. But you can kind of find that at the core of a lot of film noir things. I mean, sometimes they're simple. Double Indemnity is as simple as can be. You know, that one's simple, but usually it's this kind of, and it's almost like bullshit. And it's, it has to be expositionally explained towards the end just to make any sense of it. Who Framed Roger Rabbit does a very good job of it, actually. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is, you think, oh, it's a kid's movie, whatever, and it is, but it's also a total film noir homage. It's basically an homage to Chinatown, quite frankly, for a good chunk of it. And the whole, when you find out what the whole plotting is, it's a little bit busy. It's still easier to follow because they want to make sure kids can follow it, but it's still kind of complicated. This is complicated. The stuff with the church and the money, and they were paying this off, and is money being siphoned from the church and going into this home? And I'm just sitting there going, how big a part is this going to play in the final two episodes? And I feel like the part it's going to play is just to bring certain other characters into the trajectory of having some guilt or guilt by association for what happened. You know, like by the time we get to the end of this episode, it looks like all fingers are starting to point to that Seidel guy who's on the church board, who we probably wouldn't have even given a moment's notice for the previous five episodes other than, oh, I recognize that actor. That's about it. I'm always kind of 50-50 on those kind of things because I'm very aware you're just doing this just so we can be looking at this other character. I got a feeling if we really tried to iron out all the details with this kind of plotting, it would be kind of like, would it make perfect sense? Probably not. It's just a little bit too, this, when they talk about things getting muddled, this is the kind of thing they're talking about. The church, and I was worried the church stuff was going to make things get muddled. And this is, I thought they were talking about the stuff specific with Sister Alice, and then it turns out, nope, that's pretty clear and clean what they're doing there. It's the following the money, what's going on there. That's where it's getting a little bit hairy and complicated to me.
Yeah, it's the film noir world building that basically you build a super complex, convoluted world that our protagonist is fighting against that makes things so complicated that their success is multiplied by the fact that they're able to navigate that situation. And you implicate more people, you make more threads possible, and the fact that it can be figured out and used or worked to some advantage makes the central character more heroic. And quite interestingly, that sort of plot device leads us to the very final shot of the episode that leaves us hanging with somebody involved in that intricately after Perry decides to go out and look into this stuff after Della's done the work on it. So we'll, if the way this show's gone, my guess is they dive right into that immediately because that's sort of been the MO of the show.
Right.
So we, that may settle the issue or further complicate it, but it's set up a world that's bigger and more fraught with peril than it was before. I like the way that they've paid homage to the genre, but sort of made it their own. I think it's been very effective.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm not against what they're doing, and I understand it, and I'm following it to whatever extent I can. The way I'm watching this show for the podcast to begin with, which is, trying to watch it, trying to write things down, takes me about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes to watch a 50-something minute TV show, and then we record 15 minutes later, or whatever it is.
Right.
So, and maybe by virtue of not watching it in a more conventional way, I don't know if that would make it easier for me to follow that aspect of it, or hard, or more difficult. I don't know. It was just one of those things that as I'm taking notes, I was just like, you know, I'm not going to go crazy with the note taking on this, because I get a sense of what's going on here. And it's usually like, if you keep hearing certain things being repeated, then that's kind of like a little red flag saying, this is important, ding, 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 kind of a little filtering red light going on. And when you keep mentioning, you know, the JH initials over and over and over, and then we lead to the Jim Hicks thing, and then by the time we get to the end, we actually meet Jim Hicks, it's like, okay. And, you know, spoiler, but not really, we already see in the trailer for next week's episode that he's on the stand. So I went, oh, hey, you know what's going to happen to him on the stand? He's going to explain, we're going to get an explanation of all the stuff we've been hearing in this episode. That'll probably help clarify it, at least as far as its connection to what's going on. Because obviously this was always more than just about, you know, the death of a child and, you know, $100,000 ransom. This, I feel, this always had much bigger ramifications. But then again, I'm trying to think, it was a $100,000 ransom, correct? Wasn't that the number?
Yeah, I believe so.
I should do the math, because if 3,000 equals 45,000, so 100,000 would equal
1.5 million.
Oh, look at you. Okay. And now we're talking some real money. So, yeah, I mean, I'm, again, I wasn't against it. I was just kind of like, okay. I was more enjoying the process of getting the information and the acting around it than I was about the information itself. I hate to do it, but I'm going to do it. It's kind of like Chinatown. It's like, I'm not, and this isn't a spoiler, but who cares? I'm not so excited about the scene when Jack Nicholson's character, you know, J.J. Giddies, he's looking through the records and he sees, you know, all the names, whatever, and he's putting things together. But I'm more excited when he borrows the ruler and does the whole coughing trick to steal the page. Because, by the way, guess who kept doing that throughout high school and he would steal things from the library? Like, I can't take this issue of Rolling Stone home with me? Well, then I'm going to rip out this page. Every single week. And every time I did the same thing, I kept, and that was where the joke started to be about me. Probably actually happened years before. Scott, you act like you think there's a camera on all the time. Like I'm playing to a camera that's not there. And I'm like, yeah, because I was literally doing the coughing thing. There's no one around to even hear me do that. I'm doing it just to entertain myself. That's what I'm doing. You've got the Nicholson shades on while I'm doing it. Anyway, back to the episode.
By
saying all that means we don't need to get back into any of that money stuff, so okay, blah blah blah. We did have that interesting moment, I guess it was the third time we're in court. I think that's the point when Barnes pulls out kind of like we get the quote unquote, it's almost like the surprise witness kind of moment. You know, the person that, you know, wasn't on my list or that, or we haven't had time to prepare. Always happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be some random hotel clerk who had recognized her from something from like several months earlier. And I did enjoy, just the writer in me always enjoys this. I love him giving us voiceover, telling the courtroom a very cleaned up, sanitized, and not entirely true version of his story, but we're seeing what actually happens. That he pulls it, that guy pulls a Norman Bates. He's like, he's watching through a hole in the wall and having sex. I really kind of enjoyed the way they played that out, because there's, you know, it followed the rule of, if you're going to have a voiceover and narrate and a flashback, you can't be telling me what you're showing me. That's redundant. You gotta be telling me something, either you tell me something entirely different, or you're telling me something that's a lie and we're seeing the truth. And in this case, it was kind of more the latter than the former. But what was true was there was a kid in the other, they did leave the kid in the other room, you know, and that did make them look really bad. So when Perry explodes at her, I thought that was very well done. I really loved the moment with him and Sister Alice right after that, actually.
Yeah, I thought that it was done effectively, and there are understandable reasons on both sides. If you look at the mores of the time, I mean, you know, she's been embarrassed so much to think to tell him of that encounter. I could see how that might slip her mind. But the him being upset and thinking it looks really bad, it certainly did. And I noticed on most of the witnesses, I think all of them, maybe except the medical examiner, because we know what he saw, there were these flashbacks of differentiating what they were saying to their story. And it'll be curious to see if when the defense witnesses testify, if that device will be used as well. And with the prosecution resting this week and assuming the defense will start next week, it'll be curious to see if they use that same device to maybe. And it may be that that's when what they say matches the story to show the difference in the truth and a lie, which would, I guess, sort of break your rule, but be an interesting juxtaposition of the two ways the stories are told from the prosecution and the defense.
Right, you're referring to when Drake was on the stand, and obviously when he's telling us, of course, that's a different situation because we already know what the truth is. Kind of interesting him. He doesn't, how do I put this? He doesn't exactly lie. It's against more of a sin of omission, or he just deflects with him. That's what the detective said.
Exactly. He tells a version of the truth that is passable but isn't true to what it is. And again, I think that one of the things we've seen from I'll just call them the bad guys, you know, the prosecutors and the crooked cops is, you know, Drake would have probably been okay living with that. But then, you know, they go one step too far and try to pay him off, and that just offends some. There's something in him that offends and is one step too far that brings him back around. And
I guess I sort of agree. Oh, by the way, I muted the microphone, so again, if things sound a little off, that's why. It takes a little while for it to recover, I think. I'm suddenly sneezing tonight. I don't know. I must be the corona. and now I feel my nose dripping. So, it really does sound like it. So, I think when Drake is on the stand, and he speaks of this later when he's talking to Perry, of course, but it looked to me, just in the performance and how he was speaking, I don't think he was really hiding his guilt about what he was doing. And I think I do believe him when he says he was anticipating something. And maybe he would have went along with it. But now the sun's coming back. You know what? It's like the whole thing when your eardrums kind of pop from being on an airplane or something. That's what it feels like. Anyway, but when they, again, like you said, when they basically pay him off, when they give him like, oh, you did a good job and here's this money, which I don't think he was expecting to happen. I think that kind of, it goes beyond just being offensive to him. He went from feeling guilty about not doing the right thing to knowing he did the wrong thing.
Exactly.
And
that's his confirmation that something's rotten.
Yeah. And that if he's going to be able to look himself in the mirror and consider himself to be a remotely good and righteous man, or however you want to phrase it, he's got to do something about that. He's got to want to do. Now, obviously, initially, he tries to help Harry along with the evidence thing, you know, switching the envelope. And I actually I was confused for a moment there. It's like, but he didn't have it. He just took what Perry had in one envelope. So yeah, you could just use it after all. It's fine. Say it was there already or whatever. I got like confused just for a second. It's like, oh, it's gotta be the teeth thing. I mean, what else would it be? We keep playing with that whole denture thing this whole season. So we're waiting for that. And then it turns out not to quite work. Although I did love Perry speaking way louder than you're supposed to in a sidebar, because clearly the jury's going to hear what you're saying.
Yes.
And I am not convinced he wasn't. I'm 99% sure he's doing that on purpose.
Oh, yeah.
He has to.
For sure.
By the way, since we already talked a little bit about that moment in the chambers with the judge, which was great, whatever. Confession time. It didn't click with me. And I feel really stupid because I'm pretty sure I saw his name was in the credits when I looked up the show on IMDb a number of times. So I don't know what's wrong with me. Maybe it's just, you know, being in quarantine for so long. I don't know. It didn't click with me until this episode, until that scene in Chambers that Matt Frewer is the judge.
Really?
I just didn't hear his voice until that scene. I was like, oh gosh, that's Matt Frewer. It's like the beard's been throwing me because I'm not used to seeing Matt Frewer with facial hair. You know, I tend, whether it be Max Headroom or The Stand or a million other TV shows or movies. What movie was I just watching? He's in. I think I was rewatching part of the original Zack Snyder Watchmen movie. He's actually in that. And I don't know if I probably have. I'm forgetting. I'm sure, but I'm not accustomed to seeing him with like a big full white beard. He was in, was it Orphan Black? Was he in Orphan Black for a couple seasons too? But anyway, I'm just imagining. I didn't realize Matt Frewer was in the show. I was like, oh shit, Matt Frewer. Look, Max Headroom. Anyway, I loved what Perry did though when Drake was on the stand. The whole thing with the 40 feet, the 40 foot blood trail. And I thought that was just a great, great little piece of courtroom theatrics. That, you know, was it on one hand was a bit much, but it wasn't. It worked. I really, because it just made it believable. And I was wondering how far they were going to go with that, because that's where we know what the truth is. Is he going to push him on this?
Right.
And it's interesting how Perry didn't, because we know about the mantra about doing what's right, you know, supersedes doing the right thing is more important than doing the legal thing, or whatever the phrase is, right? And he had actually spoken about this with a couple of people, if I'm not mistaken. I think Pete and Lupe, right?
Right, right.
And if I'm not mistaken, both those people say, yeah, do it. And he keeps going back to, he gave his word. You know, he's a man, and he's a man of honor, or whatever. And even though, and we already saw that honor might have been a bit questionable earlier in the season with the letters, like giving up, you know, which basically to a certain extent, he and EB bear some responsibility for Emily being in the crosshairs ever since they were the ones who, you know, gave those letters, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right.
But it was interesting because I was watching it and I'm like, I'm honestly not sure. I was pretty sure he wasn't going to. But in my mind, I kept thinking, would it be more interesting dramatically if he decides to do it or not? And then I think he just looked at that envelope just one too many times. And like, oh, he's not going to do it. He's not going to do it, but Drake is going to come see him later. It's got to be. Plus I have that picture for the podcast, which is actually for next week. It's fine. It's just up the two of them together. So plus, you know, Perry Mason legend, you know, Paul Drake works for Perry Mason. But I really enjoyed all of that. I thought that was really some very strong stuff there in the episode.
It was, and I liked the way they showed his walk, Drake's walk out of the courtroom, and that obviously everyone in that courtroom is judging him as a black man, and you know, you see Ennis watching him. I don't know. I mean, nowadays that wouldn't happen per se, because you would separate witnesses and Ennis wouldn't be in the courtroom. At that point, still possibly being a witness. And that, I guess, sort of leads me to probably one of your favorite parts was, you know, Barnes trying to prep Ennis with Holcomb.
Yes.
And leads to an interesting twist of the plot in that group of characters. So
that is it's pretty clear that we don't really rehearse what we're going to talk about in this podcast before we record. I think our podcast is unfortunately a bit known for that. Sometimes I tell you guys what the outline is, but usually no. But you read my mind. That is exactly, not only is that exactly where I wanted to go next, while that little Pete moment I mentioned, I thought was the funniest moment in the episode, the stuff with Barnes, Ennis, and Holcomb, and then later just Holcomb and Ennis, I thought was the most fascinating part of the episode. Because, you know, how we've been saying every week, you know, some stuff we've been talking about or we're speculating about, we get an answer about. And in my thinking, we got some answers for some stuff that we might have been speculating about, as far as who knew what and
right.
who's connected to what and where. And I don't think it wasn't about anyone being right or wrong. Although I was right, but I loved it. I mean, the fact is, okay, so clearly they're just becoming aware of some of these things now, of what Ennis has done. And I love that no matter how much of a thug and a murderer, you know, this detective is, Barnes is still the one in charge in that room. Maybe it's because we obviously we're not supposed to like Barnes, but there's at least something about him that we kind of enjoy, where there's nothing enjoyable about Ennis. So he's easily the most despicable character there. So seeing someone put him in his place, even if it's just for a minute, is kind of a nice thing to see. But the fact that he even not only brings up the fact that he paid the watch commander to like jump ahead of the other guy so he would be assigned to the case, but even brought up the blood trail, I thought was very interesting. So, and it's almost unfortunate. I guess we were told, we find out later in the episode, Ennis isn't even going to take the stand after all, because they felt so comfortable they didn't need to do that. Because clearly this was something that we were looking forward to. I think Perry can still call him to the stand though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder if there might be some connection with Hicks or the people from Colorado, that's been worked on. But it's the what I liked about this was you see that Barnes is doing two things. He's telling Ennis he's full of shit, and he's telling Ennis, I don't want to know what really happened. Uh-huh. Because both of those things, I mean, it's a really bad sign if the first police officer that arrives on the scene, if for some reason that person isn't called as a witness, that's a pretty bad sign, right?
Yes.
And Barnes knows that. And I thought it was really great that they sort of expanded on that in the scene in the garage where, you know, basically he said, you know, I feel like, you know, I don't matter, so I'm just here. And Holcomb basically at that point says, well, what do you expect him to do? Because Holcomb read through that more than Barnes did. He knew really what Ennis was saying, and pushes him and gets him pretty much to confess. without telling him exactly everything that happened, but enough that Holcomb's suspicions are confirmed. And that was kind of surprising. It's like Holcomb knew they were both dirty, but he didn't think Ennis would go that far. And so I thought all those relationships were really explored and expanded in a way that we know now what each of them knew. And then, you know, Holcomb with an interesting twist at the end that, you know, I don't want to know who they are. I just want them dead.
Right. Long story short, he doesn't want anything to blow back on him.
Exactly.
Because what was mainly outside of the specific plotting of what's going on right now, backstory wise, the most telling thing about, I think, all of this was, if the way my ears heard it, at least, Holcomb got Ennis involved in these shady things with the guy, you know, with these people behind, you know, the massage parlors, the horror houses, and the grift, whatever, at the Lucky Lagoon or whatever. That was one thing. That was more about your I hate to say your typical, but you know your cops on the take. You know, your cops, you know, taking money to look the other way, kind of thing. We, you know, it was happening in the 1930s. It was happening in the 1970s. If any of you guys watched The Deuce, you know,
right?
There's a difference between doing that and, you know, murdering people. I'm going to assume that Holcomb hasn't had to kill anybody as of yet. So, although, which makes it that much more interesting, like, the guy's already killed people. If there's anyone who can, you know, who can finger them, you know, put whatever, and then, which, because if Ennis goes down, Holcomb goes down. I think that's the way he views
right.
it. So, kill whoever you have to, which could, quite frankly, even mean Perry Mason.
Well, and Ennis used Holcomb to cover him, and Holcomb didn't know it when, you know, Ennis sort of tells him he's going down, because he says, no, that was your scene. You worked that scene. Ennis really sort of lets him know they're in it together on that murder. So if that was all staged and all fake, you know, Holcomb was in charge of that murder scene. And, you know, you see Holcomb's anger and smashing his car. And I just thought that was a really neat scene between the two of them in that garage.
Well, it's what also makes it kind of interesting is if you think back to an earlier episode, I think it was Ennis talking to Pete, maybe? Was it Pete? When he basically starts throwing, shade Holcomb's way.
Yep.
He's kind of throwing him under the bus. So then you kind of connect that to this. It's like, oh, okay. Memo to self, Ennis is not who you want as a partner.
Not in any way, nope.
Basically.
Not a business partner, not, you know, your partner on a shift.
Basically, it'd be the most inappropriate thing to say, especially in light of current events, whatever. When you have a scene later with Perry talking, Drake talking about how they never partner black police officers with white police officers. Part of me wanted to say, hey, would you want to be partnered with either someone like Ennis, not to mention Holcomb? I'm going to say no.
Yeah, exactly. And just to point out a couple of the latter things, that just sort of free association in my mind, I thought it was funny. We always get the PI humor that the clerk, the sort of rough mouth clerk in Colorado, that said Ennis, it's almost like penis. you see Pete is really enjoys the sort of gruffness of that records clerk.
Oh yeah, I had a thought, and I know part of what I'm about to say probably won't thrill our female listeners, because I'm going to sound a little mean. But I had a moment thinking, you know, if that clerk was just a little bit younger, a little bit more attractive, Pete's having sex with her before he leaves.
I think P7 checks with her anyway.
Maybe we'll anyway. I know. I know. I felt bad saying it, but you know, gotta say it. Can't worry about that. Can't
worry. I think.
I don't say things to placate people. All right, go on.
I know. No, I just thought, you know, the show, right, the writer taking a subtle jab at Ennis, you know, it's almost like penis that they realize he's the biggest dick in the show. And it's, you know, it was a good jab at the character. But that, you know, and I thought the to sort of just touch briefly on Pete, the old man in the yard who looks at the two photographs and just spits on the second one. They also, you know, make reference to the Ludlow incident. I guess where the federal troops came in to break a strike and shot people, and Pinkertons worked there. And, so, I mean, you know, another nice little historical touch to this show that sort of dabbles in the history of the time. I thought that was, you know, some more nice flourishes, by the writing staff. And, I guess since we've been talking for a while, we're almost at our limit, but, I know you have a theory, and I have a question for you. You have a theory and I have a question for you.
I have a theory.
What is going to happen with this resurrection, thing with the baby?
Okay. Well, I can't remember. I can't imagine it was either one of us on this podcast. So maybe it was some foolish person online who actually speculated about the baby not being dead. That didn't happen, right? I dreamed that. No one actually said that, right? Because that's
yeah. I don't think we have.
Yeah, because I was like, no. If there's anything I'm sure about on the show, pretty sure we got a dead baby. We saw it in the morgue. Dead, very dead baby. Dead. Look, there's no way they're raising the baby from the dead. It's just obviously, that goes without saying. The question is, does something happen of a major nature in the trial that makes that moot or not? And the way they're building this up, I don't know if that's going to matter at this point.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, I can't conceive of where they're going with that. That's not going to result in, you know, the downfall of the church. And maybe that will all be connected to all this business with the church and the money and the this and the that, you know, I guess. But
that's the one part of the story that I'm like, how are they going to resolve that?
Yeah, I don't see any other way around it. So I mean, one can theorize if, you know, someone else ends up being connected to all these things. Although I don't know if there's anything that would be all that satisfying about that. Because I don't think there's any character be like, oh, it was blah, blah, blah. I doubt it. You know, oh, Elder Brown was actually behind everything all along. You know,
right.
You know, I mean, quite frankly, it's more likely to be Baggerly than that. You go out and get Robert Patrick, he's probably going to have something to do with it. And, you know, the red herring is that they think everyone's trying to get the money from him when, in fact, he's actually behind the whole thing. Because it's all about building that stupid town. Anyway, again, another one of those things, like, I don't know what this whole town thing is about, but okay.
Fair enough. I'm just, that's the one plot point that I just don't really know where it's going or headed. And it's kind of interesting, but it could be a tremendous debacle.
Yes. My concern is, my only concern is that it just, I hope however it plays out, it's done in a satisfying for our viewing kind of way. I don't want to be just left like, oh, is that it? Or, oh, they found a way around the whole thing and then this whole buildup was for nothing kind of thing. That would be,
right.
Be a little disappointed. Like, you know, you guys, you wrote yourself into a little bit of a box here. So you now deal with it, and let's watch the repercussions and the consequences of this. So I'm curious, you know, and it's hard to see how it won't be the eventual downfall of Sister Alice. And it, maybe it won't be, but I kind of think that's where they're going with it. I would be surprised. As far as anything else in the actual episode that we didn't touch on, I mean, there's little things we didn't, but I don't need to cover every single minute. We didn't talk about how the jail matron's a total bitch for lying her ass off. I was like,
wow,
whatever. She's also the woman who let, you know, the two cops just beat on Emily and didn't say a word about it, probably. Though I don't know how she could have stopped them, so I guess there's that. No. There's only one other thing, at least I'm going to give 60 seconds about, because it's the other highlight of the episode for me. We mentioned earlier about people arguing with themselves or personifying two sides of a conversation at once. We were joking about the Pete one, but we never got to the other one, which is the more notable one, because it goes on a lot longer and a lot angrier. Perry doing Perry and EB in the car towards the end of the episode.
Fantastic.
The fact he was, I mean, not simply for the fact he's doing, you know, the voice, you know, which I enjoyed that. But it was a cathartic thing because he is angry. And this is, and it kind of goes, what I really loved about it, not simply for it affording the writer and also the viewer an opportunity to kind of almost retrace everything about what's been going on with the situation and just how screwed up it is. Because that's from the writer's standpoint, to a character thing of like, and also just the fact of how horrible a thing suicide really is. Mm-hmm. And how it, when people call it a selfish act, this is very much what a selfish act, because of the lurch it left these people in with lives on the line because he couldn't get it together. So I really liked it because I thought it worked well in both a comedic sense and a dramatic sense. So gave Matthew Rhys an opportunity to really kind of let it go as well. He gets a couple of moments in the episode to let it go, but this one especially. So very much that was one of my other favorite moments in the entire episode.
Yeah, I loved it. And, you know, even the affectation of Boyo, you know, all the like he gets into EB's pattern and speech pattern and has the conversation and then ultimately argument with him and when he stops and beats on the steering wheel, just sort of stops his car because he can't go on, and then, you know, drives down. And I think what is curious about where they chose to end is that scene happens as he's on the way to Hicks's house.
Right.
And if you think of the old Perry Mason, there was sort of the, hey, we're going to have this earth-shattering revelation in the middle of the trial that's going to turn things, that it would be sort of an apropos way to do that he's sort of come to terms with EB, stops, and then goes and maybe then right after that epiphany or that resolution finds the witness that helps turn the case. So that in a way, almost like the ghost of EB, like, you know, helped him.
Right. Absolutely. Makes perfect sense. Also, and this is, I'm probably stating the overly obvious, but what else is new on these podcasts sometimes? One thing that should just be noted, just for origin's sakes, as far as there being subsequent season or seasons of Perry Mason, and just for the future of the character, again, stating something which I think is probably obvious, the fact that Perry is starting out, he's never practiced law before, he's never argued a case before, we all know, we've all watched the same six episodes. It should be noted, I think, but this was also the case that no lawyer in their right mind would take.
Right.
And I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to assume Perry is going to win this case, that they're not going to have a season and he loses the case. Well, that would be kind of amazing. I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb. You know, it's, you know, about 2 inches off the ground, and say, I'm assuming Perry will win the case. And by virtue of winning such a major, big name, big publicity, whatever case, this is what he kind of launches the success of his career upon from this point on. That would seem to make the most sense to me. And then you can see why he would be someone who would be, you know, in me, because Perry Mason that we've been introduced to is, for those of us who read the books or watch TV series, you know, he's the guy. Right now, he's not the guy yet. He wins this case, he's on track to being the guy, if that makes any sense.
Right. Right. And you were right. He shaved.
Oh, so. Yeah. Clean. Oh, by the way, that, and then before I wrap up, let's see. My notes were literally trial. Maynard Barnes opening statement. Perry's got to shave.
Yeah.
And then in parentheses, last week, Perry's got a shave. Now Perry's got a shave.
Right. Right. Well, and you see him changing. You see, you know, he has another brief interaction with Lupe and he's not, you know, she's withholding the drink from him. Says, I liked you better when you weren't a lawyer, which, you know,
I liked, hey, you, everybody. I liked you better when you were a bum. That's what's
happening. Yes, when you're a bum.
They love the word bum on this show.
They do. But, you know, not drinking as much, not, you know, taking care of himself. And you see this transformation happening in, you know, another good episode. And I guess we'll pick up. I wonder if they'll go straight to Hicks in the house or Hicks on the stand. It'll be, that's an interesting choice.
That is curious. My assumption would be, if Hicks doesn't come to the door with a gun, then we would cut to him being called to the stand, maybe. The fact that he comes to the door with a gun makes me think we're going to pick up there. I'm probably wrong, but just because it just adds another element to that.
That makes sense. It would be an interesting jump off that he comes to the door with a gun and then we immediately go to the stand. He gives his testimony and says who he was afraid of and why he had the gun.
Sure, sure.
But
we'll see. I don't.
But we'll see.
I don't know if the very first, again, I don't know what Perry's strategy is going to be here. I don't know if the very first person he would call to the stand would be to start getting into the whole church, money, incorporation, blah, blah, all that stuff. Because, you know, I mean, there's going to be a million objections. Like, what is this? What was the relevance of this? What, you know, and how much leeway is that judge actually going to give him, especially after he cursed him out in his chambers just the other day? So,
right.
I think Perry's going to be starting right off on thin ice to begin with. But we'll see. That's the fun, is just not knowing. We'll see. We don't get the first 5 minutes of next week's episode kind of preview kind of thing. Yeah. So want to stop talking about it now because we're at 107.
Yep.
I wanted to like spend 60 seconds talking about everything else I've been watching and then wrap up. So anyway, we will be back next week with chapter 7 of Perry Mason. I know we're going to do that. I do plan to apply more pressure to Brian over here. Otherwise, I'm gonna have to recruit somebody else. There will be at least one Doom Patrol podcast. I swear to God, because I have to. I have to. It's, you know, I got a message from God, and he said you have to do a Doom Patrol podcast. What's wrong with you? So I'm going to. If I have to do it by myself and I have to pretend I'm somebody else, it's going to happen. That'll be so, by the way,
no, we'll do it. It's just been a busy couple of weeks for me.
I know. Calm down. I'd like to do it before the season's over. It's, you know, I don't know how many episodes they have left. I also, there's another podcast I would like to do. I haven't contacted him yet. I may be contacting a former participant in some old serious TV drama podcasts from a few years back, because I kind of sort of want to do a one-off on Stargirl. It's much, the last few weeks, it's been the, you know, surprisingly better than I ever expected shows that I'm watching. I mean, Doom Patrol, certainly. And the current CW DC show, Stargirl, maybe it was originally a DC Universe show, but then now it's CW, whatever. Shockingly good, shockingly fun, shocking. And especially if you're an old school DC comic fan like I am, you know, so all the little nuggets you get about the original Justice Society of America, it's like, oh my God, oh my Lord, oh my God, I need to be wearing shirts that aren't so thin. people are gonna try to figure out what the joke means now, and they just gotta go, ew. Yeah, that's what I meant. So there, I know there's at least one person I can think of, maybe two, but I don't wanna go crazy, who might wanna do that. And that's kind of it. I mean, I don't know, maybe Umbrella Academy, but I wouldn't guarantee it. But definitely we're gonna finish up Perry Mason, and excited that we're gonna get another season, although it'll probably be like 2023 before it ever comes out. Oh, and oh, by the way, I just finished The Mandalorian finally.
Good show.
Holy crap.
Maybe the best thing in the Star Wars universe, maybe.
I posted online on my own personal Facebook page, not on any group page, that I had gotten through the first 5.5 episodes of The Mandalorian, and I was already prepared to say it's better than 9 of the 11 Star Wars movies. I've now finished it. It's better than 9 of the 11 Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put it ahead of the first two, Star Wars and Empire. That's crazy talk. That's a little silly. But I'll put it again over all I'll put it over the recent trilogy. The middle ones don't count. Definitely I'm sorry for all the people who seem to like cream in their pants about Rogue One. Rogue One's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's fine. But I'm sorry, y'all. I think you're all spending too much time focusing on, you know, the 5 minutes of Darth Vader at the end, and the rest of the movie's like, it's okay. It's fine. It's not the greatest fucking thing. Mandalorian's better. It just is. And the fact that they pulled that off by having your main character wear a mask the entire time, except for like for 30 seconds, kudos to them for being able to pull that off.
Yeah, totally.
Because that's more difficult than you realize. And it's also been coming a running joke with a lot of TV shows and movies when you have characters who wear masks or helmets and then they seem to not wear them all the time. And we get upset, like, why does Spider-Man's mask always have to be ripped off in all those movies or something? Or why does Iron Man not have his helmet on half the time or whatever? And this one, nope. I love that they wrote it as made a thing about the character and about their
Religion.
religion, their way of life, that they cannot remove their helmet. I kept thinking, wow, Pedro Pascal has got it made in the shade. Because I looked it up. I understand there's three different actors playing that part. There's one guy who handles all the, what they call the gunslinging moments. There's another guy who handles all the more, I guess, stunt action fighting sequences. And Pascal, it's supposed to be Pedro Pascal and all the other stuff. Of course, when you remove the other two things, how much stuff is it really? He's sitting there, I guess. I'm sorry. And I'm probably just like, is he really the guy in that outfit half the time? I'm gonna say no. I think he's no more that guy than it's like Doom Patrol. Brendan Fraser's in a studio somewhere collecting a paycheck. He basically has to record the word fuck 100 times and he gets paid.
Yes, fucking shit, over and over.
Did you watch the most recent one, by the way?
Oh yes.
Oh, I couldn't believe I just
How
was just
much
joking.
cursing?
I was just joking. About someone, I should look it up online. Someone has to be keeping track of how many times this character or this actor has cursed on the show at this point. That one episode alone was insane.
It's insane, yes.
Anyway, very much enjoying. That's why I want a podcast about it. And very glad I got to see The Mandalorian. Oh, and that music.
Oh, great music,
Oh,
yes.
that theme was. I mean, I came this close to making it the closing theme for tonight's episode, but I didn't feel like it. So anyway, if you enjoyed this podcast, you'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Perry Mason. Hey, all the stuff I just mentioned, you can talk about that there too. Doom Patrol, Mandalorian, or whatever. Talk about whatever you want there. Unlike some group pages, we don't really have that many tight rules, you know. Only if I don't like you, then I'll get rid of you. Other than that, you know, you can curse as much as you want on our page. I don't have rules. Oh, you can't use that word. You know, well, I guess maybe there might be a word you can't use. But anyway.
It's the Serious TV Duma podcast.
Yeah. You can also... you can track us down on iTunes or Apple Music, whatever hell it's called now. Serious TV Drama Podcast, subscribe to our feed, and you can rate and review us there. I don't even know how to access it anymore, so I don't even know if we've gotten any new ratings or reviews over the last few weeks. It'd be nice if we did. Someone's like, hey, finally, their audio sounds decent. Until this episode. Anyway. And you can just track us down on our actual the web hosting page where you can find those 264 of our podcasts. It's stvdpodcast.podbean.com. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. Hey, every once in a blue moon, we actually send out a tweet that's not just the link to the podcast. It doesn't happen very often, but it does actually happen. Our Twitter handle is at STVD Podcast, STVD as in serious TV drama. Okay, Brian, thank you for sticking with it and being here tonight. Man, I am totally channeling Dan with my snuffling nose right now. What the hell is going on here?
It's that time of year, and we're all inside, and you need to turn your air conditioning on, so...
Oh, yeah, that's right. I changed my shirt because I've been wiping snot on my sleeve for the last half hour.
behind the scenes stuff.
Yes, TMI. Anyway, so I will start. You can finish. So good night to everybody out there, and good night to you, Brian.
Good night, Scott, and thanks for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.